Welcome to the Strategic Investor. Join us as we interview some of the world's most productive asset managers and uncover sophisticated and unique investment strategies in the markets. Here is your host, Charlie Wright.
Hello and welcome to Strategic Investor Radio. We're on OC Talk Radio, where we bring you investment strategies you are not hearing elsewhere. We'd like to welcome for the very first time Tony Wenzel, co-founder and president of Brandometry. They're an ETF that invests using the Brand Value Index. Tony, welcome to Strategic Investor Radio.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So, Tony, you've got a background in fast-growing technology firms. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so I started my career, my real part of my career, in startup software. So most recently was selling 8 and 9 figure deals to large, highly distributed companies that included software and hardware and installation at the data center, installation at things like McDonald's restaurants or big bank branches, and monitoring of that software and equipment and management and of that equipment, and of course field break fix, that kind of stuff.
Okay, and you've been in the world of finance for about how long?
Yeah, so what happened was I had been selling these big, massive deals to banks and retailers and highly distributed enterprises, and I hit a lull. There was a point at which every CMO in banking pretty much knew who I was and what I was trying to sell them, and I couldn't move any more products, so I had to find a way to add value to them. So I commissioned a study of what the software and the solution as a whole actually delivered to CMOs and to banks and to restaurants. In this case, it was mostly banks. But and the thrust of that, I hired some folks out of a company called Brand Finance, and Brand Finance looks at the value of intangible assets and helps you figure out where your, where the value of things is actually coming from. And I hired these guys to look at what our solution delivered, and they came back with some really surprising things. We, you want to put a message at the point of sale to get people to be interested in things. So I thought there would be a very strong advertising effect, and they said, yeah, there's a fairly decent advertising effect, but the real value is in the perception of innovation that it drives among not only customers, but people who see the bank from the outside. And that was what really drove me into this brand thing. And along the road, doing a business where we were looking at how branded investment in things like support or R&D or marketing or advertising drives profit growth, risk and cost of capital, I met some guys that were trying to take these same ideas and build an ETF, and that's how I kind of got into the finance business about 2 years ago.
Okay, so Brandometry was the child that grew from that inception. So absolutely. Tell us what Brandometry is and how it's unique and different.
Yeah, so I'm grateful for that question. I would say what makes Brandometry possible is the kind of the way the economy has changed, right? So the way companies invest is different, when they get their capital, and the way corporate value is generated and measured is completely different than it was a while back. So as an organization, we're all about undervalued strong brands. So we get there in a way that I don't think any other research company does. This whole background in intangible assets, 87% of the value of the S&P resides in intangible assets, as I understand it. And this is from a lot of different experts. But in 1975, only about 17% of the value of the S&P resided in, it was mostly tangible in those days. So intangibles are unique because they're called non-rival, right? You can't use them at the same time. So, for example, if I have a tractor and I build a tractor and that's my product, only one person can use that tractor at a time. But if I build software, a million people can use the same browser at the same time. So there are also sunk costs. You can't really get a loan for doing software development. They spill over very well, so someone can steal them from you very well because it's an idea. They scale really well, and they are very synergistic. So an intangible asset works really well with other intangible assets. If you see what Apple did with the MP3 player and with compact design and mini discs and that kind of, they kind of came up with some pretty cool ideas. Anyway, I hope I answered your question. Sorry about that.
Okay. Well, let's, Tony, let's bring this down to the very basic level here. So this is an index, and it consists of what kinds of companies?
Yeah, so these are all large cap U.S. equities. You'll know the names of pretty much every single one of them. There's maybe one that some people don't know the name of, and that would be General Dynamics. And I think most people, even investors, intelligent investors, would probably know most of them.
Yeah. Okay, and so how do they qualify to be in the index?
Yeah, so that's another great question. So if we look at it as a funnel, we would start with something similar to the Russell 1000, and as we move down the funnel, we work with a company called Core Brands, who does our survey research. So when you measure the value of a brand, you usually use perceptual measurement. So that requires a lot of survey work. So Core Brands has been doing surveys of 1,000 plus companies for over 26 years, and so our universe starts with 1,000 companies that they have been calling and checking in on for a long time. So what they do is they interview folks that are C-level executives who know these companies very well. They can either do business with them or they do business with them. So to be eligible for the index as we move farther down the funnel, you got to be U.S. companies or ADRs. You have to have a market cap of over $1 billion and positive return on invested capital. But in terms of the Core Brands piece, they have a score system and they ask three kinds of questions, right? The first question is, what do you think of the management team, right? And it's a bunch of questions around how strong the management team. And the second set of questions is, how strong is the reputation of this organization, the brand itself? And then, would you invest in this company as a sophisticated investor? Would you invest? So we're basically asking experts for their opinion on this. And they come up with a score, and that score runs from 1 to 100. To qualify for the brand power index brand index, you got to have a score of 60 or higher.
Okay, and there are about how many companies in the index at any given time?
So about 50 companies. So the way it works is we're looking at the spreads between this year's brand strength and last year's brand strength as a numerator, and this year's stock price and last year's stock price as a denominator, and we normalize that volatility, and we're looking for the spreads between those, and we'll take the 50 companies with the best spreads between those two between those two measures. That makes us basically a reversion to mean kind of solution.
Okay, and you guys are long only and no leverage?
No leverage, yep, long only. We rebalance once a year. We're looking for a year-over-year change, and I think it's important to know that we're also equal weight.
Okay, you're equal weight among the 50 or so. So let's see if I understand this. So you guys go to the marketplace, the smart money marketplace, people who are familiar with Walmart and IBM, et cetera, companies that we've typically have heard of, and you get their input as to these smart money executives, what they think of the companies you're looking at, and you take those that have the most positive responses, and you say they basically offer to the marketplace the most popular brands, the brands most likely to perform well and be profitable over time, not necessarily in the next 3 months, but over time. And you create an index with that, and then you go in and you buy shares in those. You don't do any shorting, you don't do any fancy stuff, and you hold that and then rebalance once a year with the idea that these companies have intangible value in their name and their mode of operations. Is that basically it?
Yep, that's the thrust of it. We're looking for strong, undervalued brands. So you'll see companies like Apple or Bristol Myers or Facebook or Intel or Kraft, Nike companies, and we'll look at them. We interestingly, from time to time, we'll have some graphs that'll show you where the gains came over time. So I remember we had a slide in one of our decks that showed Nike and Microsoft and Tiffany and a couple others. But the thrust of it was, Nike was a great one for us to own. Tiffany was a great one for us to own. But we didn't do well on Microsoft. So at certain times, it just didn't grow in the way we thought it would based on the index.
Yeah. Well, that was years ago.
Yep.
It's done okay in the past couple of years here. So
no, they've done
very well. So to understand this, you don't use any fundamental analysis, whether or not they pay a dividend. Is that dividend growing? Are their earnings growing, et cetera? You don't look at any of that stuff?
No, so it's the brand strength score change over the stock price score change. So we're not looking at fundamentals or factors in a sense. So we're really taking expert opinion and saying, hey, what do you think of how strong these companies are? And based on that strength, we're presuming that there's going to be a reversion to the mean of their stock price.
Okay. But if there's a reversion to the mean, how are you able to take advantage of that if you're long only?
So we rebalance once a year, so we're going to get different sector exposure and different constituents. We roll over about 40% a year. So and historically, we've done pretty well against the S&P. Historically, you know, we've beaten the S&P with higher dividends and lower volatility.
Okay, well, that's very interesting. So you don't try to time different sectors or companies' improvement. You just or higher prices. You just recognize that reversion to the mean is going to be a natural process, and so by rebalancing, you're looking to take advantage of that.
Yeah, that's when we can get to capture the upside, I think, a lot for a lot of these companies. And it's interesting. You know, a lot of people will say, you know, is this something bad will happen with a company's brand? And we'll say, you know, everyone will say, well, this is not necessarily a good thing. But, you know, for us, it's kind of like, maybe that's a buying opportunity.
Yeah. So, for example, companies that we have seen, certainly GE, Boeing in the past 2 weeks, and Wells Fargo. Okay, you know, with all of the negative news there about them, et cetera, are you guys typically able to foresee some of those things because of the input from these surveys, or typically not?
It's a great question, and we asked this question about a company in our index recently, and that company was Kraft Heinz.
Yeah,
we're trying to say, well, why weren't we able to figure out that you know, these guys were trying to hold the line on pricing, and that it was not working, and the vendors were upset. And I guess my thought on it, and I don't have an answer that's empirically accurate, but my thought on it is, brand takes a while to trickle down. It just takes a while for the perceptions that individuals have to actually hit the reality of what is. And we bank on that on the upside, and I think sometimes on the downside we'll miss it because it just doesn't move quickly enough. Now, some of these other things like Boeing, I think they're going to move pretty quick. Right? I mean, those tragedies, the Volkswagens, the Chipotles, where people are making, you know, decisions that are super painful. Those things, I think that they are going to cause problems in a quicker way. But these other sorts of things that are kind of hidden in the corporate veil, or, you know, they take longer to get out.
So what misperceptions about what you guys are doing do you find is fairly prevalent among investors and advisors?
Yeah, I'd say there's a lot of style fetish, I think. You know, we do it this one way. and I would say there's a trillion ways to do it wrong, but there's probably a million ways to do it right. Lately, I've noticed a lot of emphasis on performance chasing over kind of exposure targeting. And so, you know, this is the kind of exposure we're trying to look for. But in terms of brand, I think a lot of folks feel like brand is necessarily a timing game, and it isn't necessarily kind of a more strategic game that you can play. I would say those are probably the key ideas in that misperception arena.
Okay, and what objections do you come up with? Do advisors and investors come up with, and how do you respond to those objections?
Yeah, well, we're a new ETF, so we hear a lot of them, and I think there's still a lot of misunderstandings about how ETFs work. So the main one, I think, would be about liquidity, and I think people have a sense that ETFs have or have not a certain level of liquidity, when in fact, what's in the ETF, the basket, is really where the liquidity comes from. And so a lot of folks will say, well, I'm a little worried, you know, you're not very liquid. And I'll say, well, you know, the stocks in our basket are, almost every one of them is a Fortune 500 company, and they trade 925 million times on average every day. So, that's, you know, they're pretty liquid. So the other thing is kind of the AUM, right? So when you're a small ETF, everyone wants to know that you're a big ETF. And there are certain unwritten rules, you know, that I think people have about how they want to invest and who they want to invest with. And I think some of those are related to how many assets you have managed to collect to date.
You know, that always interests, if not intrigues me, because one of the things you learn early on in the investment world is that to have a large amount of capital to invest is not an advantage. It is a disadvantage. You can't go in and be nimble and quick and buy here and sell there. You've got to take time to buy things. Otherwise, you're going to impact the stock price and time to sell things. And so when people say, oh, I only work with companies that have $20 billion. Hey, pal, you're handicapping yourself. Or you may be.
Yeah, definitely. That's the Berkshire Hathaway kind of paradox, right?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So it interests me to hear that. So, Tony, moving on just a little bit here, what's the best advice you've ever heard, read, or received about investing?
Yeah, I would say the best advice I ever had is just be in the market early, meaning when you're a kid even, and always be in the market. Because if you're not invested on, what would they say, the top 10 days of the market, you're lucky to be flat. Right, but if you're in the market, you're smiling because nobody knows what day the linchpin of your future is going to strike. It could be right in the middle of the worst market ever. So I think that the best advice is just to always be in the market.
Yeah, it's kind of like people often say about getting into real estate, or well, when should you plant a tree? They'll say, well, 20 years ago. What's the second best time to plant a tree? Today. Okay, so
yes, no, absolutely, move.
So, who are the buyers of your ETF as far as you know? Are they retail investors, any institutional investors?
Yeah, I don't know that we're getting a lot of retail or institutional at this point. You know, right now our target is advisors and broker-dealers that have $5 billion or less in AUM, and that's because there's a lot of, again, these rules about who large broker-dealers will invest with and that sort of thing. And a lot of those things, I think, are holdovers, you know, from the mutual fund world. But either way, they kind of preclude us from calling on a Merrill or a Morgan Stanley until we hit, you know, I think at least $50 million in assets. So that's our target right now, is the $5 billion or less group.
Okay, and typically advisors who recommend your fund, okay, what are the main reason or reasons they're recommending it? They think that, you know, brands is easily understood by people and that, you know, probably over time they're going to outperform?
Yeah, I think that's part of it. So it's interesting because we can act as a core component, you know, maybe take over some of your beta stuff because we're going to be a little bit more performant and probably a little less volatile. Or we can be, you know, a more of a satellite type of approach. And, you know, we've got clients that speak to both. You know, I would say we're kind of a blend. If you look at us in a style box, we're going to be a blend of, you know, of value and growth. And we've got folks on both sides of that kind of continuum. And I don't want to get religious with them because I'll take either one.
Yeah. I got you. And that was going to be my next question of how you're doing on growth versus value, because all you read about value is it's been struggling and will probably continue to struggle. So do you keep track of that and use that in any way in establishing the index, or you just take all comers here?
Yeah, well, look, I think it's important to look, you've got to have some of your portfolio in the market and in fast-moving, momentum-driven things in a market like this. When does that stop? Who knows? But, you know, as an equal weight and as a value, right, that's going to put us at a disadvantage in a market that's, you know, in a dead run. But when things slow back to, you know, to a broad reach, you know, I think we're going to start to come back and look like a more interesting kind of thing. So I think it's just a matter of what exposures are right for folks at, you know, at any given moment, and whether they're thinking, okay, it's been pretty good for a while. We're going to get defensive, or we're going to, you know, depending on where you sit in your prognosis for the economy.
Yeah. So tell me, I would think, and let me know if this is not accurate, but I would think that the companies you have, because of their size, they're going to have greater international exposure. And there are times when that can be a real disadvantage. And moving forward with tariffs and all kinds of things that are happening, we could well be coming into the next couple of years or so where that's the case. Do you guys consider that at all? Do you agree with that? How do you see this international exposure and the potential disadvantage it could be for your index?
Yeah, it's this particularly, you know, this currency kind of situation, and you know what's going on, and with this China becoming so big, and you know, and the disrespect they seem to have for intellectual property and tangible assets generally. So it is something we worry about. We don't have a strategy really for manipulating currencies to our advantage yet, but we're thinking about it all the time. But yeah, I think you're onto something. I would totally agree with you. I think that this is an important thing to consider. You know, if you're putting together a portfolio, is how does a Schmuckers or a Sherwin Williams compare to maybe someone like a Microsoft or a Morgan Stanley or a Kellogg or an IBM, who's going to have a little bit different sort of exposure.
So here's another question we'd like to ask all of our guests here, Tony. What keeps you awake at night?
Yeah, it's funny you hit on it in the last question. And I think about what Thucydides would have had to say about the U.S. and China, right? I mean, so for those who don't know, Thucydides was an Athenian general, and he's credited with the Pericles funeral oration. So maybe if you remember that from college, but he had
I was out of college by then.
That's right, in 400 BC. But he had a journal of the Peloponnese War between Sparta and Athens in the 5th century, and this idea of the Thucydides trap is that the declining power, let's just say that's the United States, has to push, there's a momentum for war against the rising power, which, in this case, let's just say it's China. You know, and I worry about that momentum and what it means for my kids, and I worry, what the Chinese imperialism and hegemony looks like, and I wonder what that means for freedom for the world, because I feel like they have a different vision of where they fit in the global structure. I also worry about the levels of debt that the government has and that companies have and households have, and I ask myself at what point can we not afford to pay our debt? And I think, in terms of this industry, the ETF industry in general, I worry that the industry is really sharpening the knife that's going to cut its throat by lowering fees all the time. These companies can play the stock lending game in a market like this, but what happens when the economy goes bare?
Yeah.
Should we be worried about big companies again? Because they're basically taking away their own income, and I don't hear a lot of clamor for, hey, please lower my fees another 40 bips.
Jack Bogle and others have played that chord for so long, people have gotten in line, want to adopt it, who don't know what they're talking about. Not that fees are not important, but they have seemed to be the latest hyper-focus over the past few years. And like you say, that can lead in some wrong directions here, but that's not what we're going to talk about today. A final question we've asked all of our guests: what book on investing would you recommend for our listeners?
Interesting. I know it'll sound odd, but I like Business Adventures by John Brooks. I don't know if that's a book you're familiar with.
I'm not.
I read it because I had heard it was one of Bill Gates' favorite books, and there's some great stories and case studies that really show you how, like, when the wheels come off, like, what's really happening and how leaders try to address them. And, one of the most interesting ones I can recall is, like, the 1962 flash crash and how that created just chaos that ruined, like, 100-year-old companies, like, in 10 minutes. And it's just fascinating to dig into those. They talk a little bit about I remember Piggly Wiggly. This guy, people were specking, and he went after them and ended up almost bankrupting himself. And Xerox created the copy machine, and then felt like they were on top of the world. And then everyone seemed to catch up while they weren't looking. And lessons from Bretton Woods, and just really interesting stories told from the inside. In a way that you just kind of go, oh wow, there's a lot of drama in them, and you could feel the stress these people were feeling and what it really, what it was like to be there.
Hey, well, Tony, thank you very much. No one has recommended that. So again, the title and the author again, quickly.
Adventures in Business, and the author is John Brooks.
Okay, Brooks.
That's right.
Okay, thank you very much for that. And to add a little tag to that, based upon what you said, you're concerned about keeping you awake at night, anything that David Stockman says, writes, or thinks about, you and he would be band of brothers here. And that debt involved.
That kindred soul out there.
Yeah, that's right. He was, of course, I think the budget director for Ronald Reagan, was much younger then, obviously, went to that from U.S. Congress. But he's been singing that tune for some time. I read his 750-page book, I don't know, 7 or 8 years ago probably, and he's still singing that tune on YouTube and the like. But at some point it's going to come home to roost, and no question about it, debt is not something we can continue to ignore. But again, they're not listening to you and me on that, so
unfortunate.
Whether they're Democrats or Republicans, they spend. So for those who would like to know more about Brandometry, or you and your nine-year-old twins, or anything like that, where would they go?
Sure. We're at www.brandometry.net, B-R-A-N-D-O-M-E-T-R-Y. So that's probably one of the great places. We have a fairly decent bunch of videos on YouTube, and you could look us up on YouTube. And our Twitter hashtag that we use a lot is hashtag Brand Value Matters.
Okay. So final words for our listeners here, Tony.
I would say if intangible assets were an asset class, it would be the biggest one in the world. And brand is the biggest slice of that intangible asset pie. So we're trying to find a way to invest in it. So, brand value matters, and, we're all about undervalued strong brands. That's what I would say.
Tony, we've got to congratulate you. ETFs are, about a decade, about a century old now, and there are thousands of them, and there are next to none that are unique. And we've got to hand it to you guys for coming up with a unique way to approach the marketplace. And you guys have done it. It all sounds, reasonable. So our best wishes to you and to Brandometry.net in continuing to be successful and effectively impacting people positively people's financial life. So thank you very much for being with us here today, Tony.
I'm super grateful. Thank you.
Again, we've been talking with Tony Wenzel, co-founder and president of Brandometry.net. You've been listening to Strategic Investor Radio on OC Talk Radio, where we bring you investment strategies you are not hearing elsewhere. And you can contact us at info@strategicinvestorradio.com and go to our website to hear podcasts of all of our interviews and shows, strategicinvestorradio.com. I'm Charlie Wright, wishing you an enjoyable week and productive investing.
Strategic Investor Radio is a production of OC Talk Radio and is provided for educational purposes only. Content of this program and the views of the guests should not be considered as recommendations by OC Talk Radio or investment advice from the host, Charlie Wright, or any other entity attached to this production. Investors should always consult qualified financial, investment, tax, or legal professionals prior to investing.